Yanu La Zaman Hazé. We started a little bit later this year than normally. That is totally my fault. That is not on the education committee or Jerry or anyone else. I take full responsibility for that. But Baruch Hashem, we have the opportunity to begin a new limud. So we're staying within Masechah Sanhedrin. Last year we did Perek Zebor Lo Echad, which is the third Perek of Sanhedrin. Now we're going to do the eighth Perek of Sanhedrin, Ben Sur Mora. Those are probably the two most popular Perekim of Sanhedrin, together with the first Perek. It's also a very popular Perek to do. This is a bit of a different limud, and it's deliberately chosen, whereas Zeborer is more of what we would call a Shas Perek. It has sugyas with wide-ranging ramifications through lots of other mesechtos, lots of principles that animate the entirety of the halachic system. Ben Sur Mora is a bit more narrow. We are going to do some broader topics as the Perek progresses, but it's a little bit more self-contained. And insofar as we're doing a little bit of different style this year, the Shiurim hopefully will be a little bit more self-contained as well. I think Ben Sur Mora might be a little bit of a better limud for that style. So, appropriately, the first sugya that we will be studying within Perek Ben Sur Mora is the topic of the Ben Sur Mora, or what we know as the wayward son. Now, for those who plan on doing the limud on their own, I would just advise that really the first four blot, the first four dapim of Perek Ben Sur Mora, Samaches really through Ayin Beis, are really all about this sugya. And as you'll see already on tonight's Maar Makomo sheet, we'll be addressing Gemaras on Samaches, on Ayin Aleph, on Ayin Beis, and really through this sugya, it's kind of really one self-contained unit. So it's helpful to see all the Gemaras together, really, the entire four daf when approaching the sugya. Now, of course, again, I'm always going to provide the particular gemaras that are necessary on any particular night, so it's not at all necessary to do that. But in a vacuum, it is helpful to see all four of those dafim in order to approach this topic of Mitzvah Rumor. But for tonight, let's get a little bit of an introduction to this topic. So we'll begin, the most obvious place to begin, is with the psukim themselves. We have four psukim that describe this wayward son, what happens to this wayward son, who he is, four psukim that appear in Parshas Ki Tsetse. And they appear in Source 1. So we'll begin just by reading the psukim together. Ki yela ish bein soreru mora, inenu shomea b'kol avivu b'kol imo, v'yisaru oso v'lo yishma aleihem. A person has a wayward son. This appears right after the Parsha of Eish HaSifas Toar, and Rashi has a whole explanation for that, but we'll just deal internally with the Parsha itself. A person has this rebellious child. He's not listening to the voice of his father and the voice of his mother, and V'yisruosov L'Yishma Aleihem, they tell him off and he doesn't listen to them. He's really not listening to his parents. As someone who is the proud parent of a child in the terrible twos, this Parsha speaks to me personally in many ways. I have a super defiant child who I love dearly, but this is a child who's a little bit older, as we will see in the Gemara. He's samach l'ish, and he's rebelling against his parents. His father and mother literally seize him, they grab him, and they take him to the elders of the city, to the gates of the place where they live. They tell the elders of the city that he is rebellious, so Alel Vesovei, we'll talk about what that exactly means as we go forward. He's gluttonous in some way or another. Urgamuhu kolanche iroba avanim vames, viyartara mikarbechel chol Yisrael yishmu biyirau, and he is stoned, which seems like a rather harsh punishment, as the Gemara itself will note. It seems like a rather harsh punishment for his crimes. He receives skila, the most harsh, according to the way we paskin, the most harsh of the four misos based in. You shall remove the evil from among you. Everybody in Am Yisrael shall hear and they shall witness what happens to this child. When I was in Gush for the year, I remember Parshas Ki Tsetse, I remember fondly my Israeli Chavrusa, that entire week was singing the song, B'neinu Zesoreru More. He went through the whole part, and the high part was, Urgamuhu. He was like very excited about this. So it was very exciting for the Israelis in yeshiva. But for most of us, this is not the most uplifting passage per se in Torah Shebech Tzav. But we have four psukim that basically outline this category, this halachic treatment of this child who's the Ben Sur Mora, this wayward son. Now, perhaps the most famous Gemara on Ben Sur Mora is the Gemara that appears in Source 2, which is not even so much a halachic Gemara, but it attempts to characterize for us the prevalence, or lack thereof, of this whole parsha of Ben Sur Mora. The Gemara of Ayin Aleph Amid Aleph says, Keman azla ha desanya, Ben Sur Mora lo hayav lo asid lihyos. whose opinion is it that the Bensarar Umora was never created, never existed, and will never in the future exist? I think they're Mayim Makomos on the Shtender. Are they on the... If you could just bring the whole stack. Thank you. So the Gemara says, whose opinion is it that the Bensarar Umora was never created and will never exist? V'lama nechtav drosh v'kab al-schar. And why was it written? In order to darshan, in order to try to understand it, to penetrate its depth, and in doing so to receive reward. Keman, whose opinion is this? Rabbi Yehuda. This is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. We'll see what Rabbi Yehuda's opinion is. It's a pretty remarkable opinion. He says that it has to be a case where Ava v'imo are shavin, bekol b'mara uvakoma. The child's parents have to be the same height, they have to look the same, and they have to have the same voice. So on the basis of that, the Gemara says that probably never happened, that it probably never will happen, so it's Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. Okay, fine. Ibai Zema, the Gemara offers an alternative opinion. Rabbi Shimoni, or it's Rabbi Shimon. Desanya, for we learned another price. Amar Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon says, V'chi mebnesha achal zeh tartei mar basar v'shasa chazi log yayin ha'italki ave v'imo mutzinos o l'salka. Because he steals a little meat, a little wine, his parents are going to take him to Beistin in order to deliver this most stringent of capital punishments. Elo hayav lo asid lehios. Rather, no. It clearly never happened, and it clearly never will happen. V'lama nechtav drosh v'kab el-sachar. Why was it written? So that you can learn the topic, and you can receive reward for it. Now, before we talk about that, Amar Rabbi Yonasan, just to finish source number two, Rabbi Yonasan says, Ani re'isiv v'yashavti al-kivro. That's probably less famous. People don't realize that famously everybody says, Bensarar Umora lo hayav lo nivra. It never existed, it never will exist. But then Rabbi Yonasan in the very next line says, no, it did exist, I saw it myself, and I was at his tomb, I was at the cemetery, I saw where he was buried. So Rabbi Yonasan maintains that it very much did exist, but I think the view that's gained more currency is the first view quoted in the Gemara, in the Braisa, Rabbi Shimon or Rabbi Yehuda, that it was never created. Now, this is a pretty... It's a critical, it's a very important Gemara in terms of our hashkafa of how we understand Talmud Torah in many ways. Obviously, one value of Talmud Torah is Psukei Shmaitza Alib de Hilchasa, is trying to understand what the halacha is, and the Torah serves as a guide for how we are supposed to act, how we are supposed to lead our lives. But there's an entire area of Torah that exists within Drosh V'Kab El Sachar. Now, obviously, this is a bit of an extreme example, because the Gemara is saying it was never existed, lo hayav lo asid lihios, whereas most things in Shas have some potential contemporary application, or at least an application of Bizmane Mashiach. But, that being said, many areas of Shas that we study on a regular basis don't have immediate application, or don't have obvious application, or have applications that don't come up on a regular or frequent basis. So the Gemara here says, drosh v'kav el sachar. Now, one option of learning that is just, oh, it's more Torah, so you can learn it and you can receive reward for it. And certainly that would just be the simple reading of the words. I think, as we will see, Be'ez Hashem, as we go forward, as is the case with all areas of Torah Shebal Peh, when one properly understands the Bensarar Umora, when we begin to try to penetrate the conceptual underpinnings of this topic, try to understand what's actually going on, there is much that the Bensarar Umora tells us about the Torah's hashkafa and the Torah's perspective on life and the system of halacha and the da'as ha-bore, the divine will as expressed through the halacha, that we can actually derive from Bensarar Umora. We are going to do that consistently. Now, obviously, again, that's not tied to the strict legal analysis, but as is always the case, when we conduct that legal analysis and afterwards zoom out a little bit, we can derive very important hashkafic theological principles from this topic of Bensarar Umora. So drosh v'kab al-schar, it's not just we learn it and receive reward. Obviously, Torah Lishma dictates that on one level, that is certainly the case. But I think Torah Lishma on another level dictates that when we properly understand the Torah, we properly understand, once again, the conceptual principles that animate the halacha, and we put those into a broader framework, we actually emerge with rather significant principles that emerge from this topic of Mitzvah Remora. And that is what we are going to Be'ez Hashem do. But before we do that, let's at least engage in the process of trying to understand from a conceptual standpoint what this Bensarar Umora is all about. And the topic that I chose for tonight is the topic of Nidon Al Shem Sofa. The words that literally mean he is judged by his end. He is judged by his future trajectory, where he will ultimately end up. And this line comes from a Mishnah that appears in Masechet Sanhedrin on Daf Ayin Aleph Amud Beis and is quoted in source number 3. Mishnah. Bensarar Umora Nidon Al Shem Sofa. This Bensarar Umora is judged by his end, by his ultimate trajectory. Yamus Zakai, Al Yamos Chayev. We want that he will die, Zakai, in a state where he is not literally, Chayev is obligated, right? It seems like we don't want to allow him to pursue his trajectory to ultimately reach a point where he is Chayev, where he is wicked, where he is a Rasha, where he deserves Misa. So we are proactively going to administer that capital punishment now so that he doesn't reach that point. It almost seems like we're somehow saving him spiritually. Yamos Zakai velo Yamos Chayev. And we're actually going to see that concept developed as this parak continues. In other areas as well, we will see perhaps the notion that in certain circumstances, maybe you could even kill someone in order to do them a service, in order to save them from spiritual catastrophe. You're obviously bringing the ultimate physical catastrophe, or you're ending their life, but you're doing so in order to save them from some kind of spiritual detriment. And that's what it sounds like in the first line of this Mishnah as well. And the Mishnah goes on to explain, Shemisasan shal resha'im hana'a lahen behana'a l'olam, latzadikim ra'a lahen v'ra'a l'olam. In truth, the death of a Rasha is good for the world. There would be less sin and iniquity in the world. And it's actually good for them as well, because you're saving them spiritually. They're not going to be able to continue to pursue that path of wickedness and bring further detriment, spiritual detriment, upon themselves. When the righteous die, that's bad for them, because they're engaged in Torah and mitzvos over the course, when they are present in Olam Hazeh, in this physical world, and it's bad for the world as well, because they offer us spiritual guidance, they serve as a zechus for us through the righteous things that they do. Now, just entirely parenthetically, the notion that the death of a tzaddik is ra lahen is also a very interesting hashkafic point. Is that really true? We would tend to assume that it's not really so bad for them, because what happens when a tzaddik dies? Then they enter the Masifta Derakia, they receive their ultimate reward, they receive a greater proximity to HaKadosh Baruch Hu than they could have ever received. So there are certainly different ways of reading this line. You could say, what?
Can't dismiss us anymore.
Okay, so good. So I'm about to get there. Good, and the famous story of the Gruah, right? A couple famous stories about the Gruah. Now, on one level, you could just say it's Ra Lohen, because they could have done even more mitzvahs and they could have received even greater reward. I think the way that Rav Soloveitchik would probably read this Mishnah, and I don't know this definitively, he doesn't quote this in Halachic Man, but the Rav argued that for Tzadikim, really, it is better to be in Olam Hazeh. Because as Meir was saying, Olam Hazeh is where we have an opportunity to do mitzvahs. That is where we have the opportunity to actually perform meaningful spiritual acts. There's a famous story that he does quote in Halachic Man about the Vilna Gaon, who was lying on his deathbed, and he was crying. And his Talmidim asked him, why are you crying? You're about to go are you worried about your chelak in Olam Haba? And the Gruah famously held on to his tzitzis. And he said, for a few pennies, I can purchase a baguette of tzitzis, fulfill a mitzvah de'oraisa constantly, and now I go to a world where I will no longer be able to perform mitzvahs. Which is, again, it's a powerful theological idea, the notion that the true desire of halachic Jew is not to receive reward for one's mitzvos, it's to do mitzvos. It's to do meaningful spiritual acts that bring us closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You could tie that into the Mishnah of the first parak of Maseches Avos. Hevu avadim ha-mesham shenis rav shelo al-manas l'kap pras. It's not about receiving reward, it's about doing things. A mushal that Rabbi Karmi once gave, Rabbi Karmi Shlita, he once compared it to Lahavdil, a baseball player, playing versus going to the Hall of Fame. So if you ask any player, right, they're not looking forward to their retirement when they'll be able to be Mekabel Sachar and be joined to the Hall of Fame. It's about the here and now. It's about playing. It's about doing. It's about winning. It's about achieving, right? So you don't like the mushel?
No.
What are you telling them?
They get paid when they play.
Oh, you're saying it's about the money. So okay, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. But if you're dealing with a real lishma player, right, the idea would be that perhaps you don't think that exists. Okay, perhaps. But perhaps if such a thing did exist, the idea would be, okay, that I hear your kasha. It's a good kasha. But when someone is really invested in what they are doing, it's not about the reward that you are going to receive afterwards. It's about the meaningfulness of the endeavor itself. And that's a very powerful idea when it comes to Torah and mitzvot. It's not about, like I tell my students all the time, Torah Judaism is not a big game of Mario where you like collect the coins and you avoid the little, well, what are those things called? The little Goombas, whatever. No one knows Mario, Super Mario. No one told
it.
Turtles. Okay, fine. You avoid the turtles and you like collect the coins, right? Sometimes we view Yahadus that way, like it's just avoiding the averos and collecting the mitzvos in order to receive reward afterwards. Tzadikim, misas tzadikim is ra'lohim. The endeavor itself of Torah and mitzvos is something that's self-justifying, that has deep resonant meaning that we don't look forward to the end of that process, chas v'shalom. That process, again, it's self-justifying, it is life itself. So you have that, again, that's a total parenthetical point of the notion of tzaddikim ra'lehem ra'le olam. And then the Mishnah goes on to go through a number of other things that are good for tzaddikim, good for rishayim, bad for tzaddikim, and vice versa. Yayin v'sheinah l'rishayim hanalahem hanal olam. If a rasha gets drunk and sleeps, it's hanah for that person. They receive enjoyment, and it's good for the world as well, because they're not continuing to do averos. V'la tzaddikim ra'lehem ra'le olam. It's not good for a tzaddik to become drunk. It's not good for the world, because they're no longer engaged in Torah and mitzvos. Pizur the Rishayim Hana Alehem Bana Olam. When Rishayim are spread out, when they're not concentrated in a particular location, that is good for them, because they don't reinforce the bad activity that they are all performing, and it's good for the world as well. There's a fascinating piece in the Drashos Haran where he says that part of the motivation, perhaps, for the Pizur, what is the ultimate Pizur that's recorded in Torah, the ultimate spreading out? This is Migdal Bava, right? So the Drashos Haran says perhaps one of the reasons for the dispersion that occurs in Migdal Bavel was in order to save Abraham. He really makes this, it's a very novel interpretation, but it's an interesting one. He says that if you look at Jewish history, right, there was always one nation that expelled us and that persecuted us, and there was always another nation that would take us in. And he said if you had everyone concentrated in a single society that was unified, that governed the entire world, then the moment they would decide to press certain anti-Semitic tendencies and persecute Jews, Avraham and his progeny would have nowhere to flee. So Pizur L'Rasha'im, the Ran says, is a good thing for the world, is a good thing for the Jews, because they are spread out. But for tzaddikim, it's Ra'lahem Ra'la Olam, Kinos L'Rasha'im, the flip side, etc., etc. Good. Now, this is the first time we have this notion of Nidon al Shem Sofo. We are going to see another Mishnah in this same parak that has this phrase as well, Nidon al Shem Sofo, and that is Hababa Machtaras. We'll talk about the person who tunnels into another's home, and the Baal Habayis, the owner of the household, has the right to kill the person who invades his home under the assumption that the person who invaded his home is actually going to kill him. We have that same phrase, Nidon al Shem Sofo. Now, the question that we are going to have to raise, and actually, you know what? Before we look into this question, let's take a look at source number 4. Because source number 4 is the standard elucidation of this notion of Nidon al-Shem Sofo. The Gemara Daf Ayin Bezim Aleph says, Tanya, we learned in a Braisa, Rabbi Yossi Aglili Omer, Rabbi Yossi Aglili says, B'chim im neisha achal zet tartemar basar v'shasa chatzi lo yayin ha'italki amra Torah yetzi lebeistin li sakel. Okay, so he can't control himself. He loves eating, he loves drinking, he's stealing a little bit. Okay, he's not our role model. We're not going to put him on a poster. We're not going to advertise him. We don't recommend his behavior. We don't advocate for his behavior. But is that really so bad that he deserves skila and basin? He deserves the worst of capital punishments? Elihigia Torah l'sof da'ato shel ben sora umora. No, the Torah did a little bit of analysis and recognized where his trajectory is ultimately going to lead him. Shasof megamer nifse aviv muvakesh limudo ve'eno motzei. What's going to happen? He's going to finish stealing from his father. His father's going to go broke. He's going to keep stealing from his parents until his parents no longer have any assets. They're not going to be able to fund his habits anymore. He's going to try to find more money in order to continue muvakesh limudo, in order to continue on the trajectory that he's been on until now, mevakesh limudo, ve'eino motzei, and he's not going to find it in his parents' household. So what's he going to do? V'yetze l'parshas drachim umelastem es abrios. He's going to head out to the road, and what's he going to do? He's going to start harassing the populace. He's going to start harassing the populace in order to receive money. There's a concern, the standard interpretation, and again, we're going to work on this more in future weeks, but the standard interpretation is that he's going to ultimately kill someone, which warrants capital punishment. And again, that doesn't explain everything, may not explain skila. Again, we're going to talk about that in the future. But because he's ultimately going to do that, we proactively give him the punishment now in order to avoid that fate. Amra Torah, Yamos Zakai, Al Yamos Chayav. And then here we just repeat the language of the Mishnah. He should die in a state of Zechus, where he is not Chayav, and he shouldn't die in a state where he has already brought that wickedness upon himself. Shemi Sasan Shavashayim Hanalahem Hanala Olam, exactly as the Mishnah stated, etc., etc., etc. Now, the first critical question, conceptual question, that we are going to have to raise with Ben Sora Umura is how literally do we take this notion of Nidon al-Shem Sofo? how much, when we say that we put a Bensoru Umura to death, is this really only a result of the activities that he will ultimately do? Are we really saying that it's fully a proactive punishment and it has nothing to do with what he has done to this point, what he has done until now? Or are we saying Nidon al Shem Sofo in one sense, but really the Chiyuv Misa and the Isur that the Bensoru Umura, the Chiyuv Misa, the punishment that we are giving him, is not only a function or even primarily a function of what he will do in the future. It's not a proactive punishment, but it is really a result of the sins that he has already done. Now let's just take a look back at source number 3, at the language of the Mishnah. First, the Mishnah begins, Bensoru Umura Nidon al Shem Sofo. He is judged by his end. That clearly implies that what? That it is a proactive punishment because of the trajectory that he is on and because of where he will ultimately end up. Nidon al Shem Sofo. Yamos Zakai v'al Yamos Chayev. Sounds like the same thing. If we're calling him Zakai right now, then we're saying that he doesn't really deserve this punishment. At the very least, we're saying he doesn't deserve this punishment. We're saying it doesn't really sound like he's a Rasha. But then, look at the very next line in the Mishnah. Shemisason shel Rasha'im hana'a lahen b'hana'a la'olam. The death of a Rasha is good for them and good for the entire world. Now, if we are saying that, the simple reading of the Mishnah would imply that the Bensoru Umura already has a status of what? Has a status of Rasha. If we're saying hana lahen v'hana la'olam, it seems like we're saying that he is a Rasha, and therefore it is actually good for him if he is put to death now. Now, all of these lines can be read differently. When it comes to Nidon al Shem Sofo, we can say that it really is a punishment for his sins, but his sins wouldn't be bad enough within the context that they were performed. They need to be within the context of a... They need to be viewed within a broader context of what he is going to do. When we view this not simply as an isolated act of what he is doing, but an act that is put within a broader framework of what he will inevitably do, it becomes much, much worse. And because of that broader context, we view his sin that he has already committed in a different light, and because we view it in a different light, we are going to punish him more stringently. And the same can be said for Yamos Zakai v'al Yamos Chayev. Now, alternatively, one can say, and we will see, I wouldn't have said this myself, but we will see Achronim who say this, you could also learn these lines as somewhat lav davka. It's Nidon al Shem Sofo. It's giving you a kind of hashkafa behind Bensoru Umura. When the Gemara on Daf Ayin Beis Amud Aleph says that, oh, we're judging where he's going to end up, and based on where he's going to end up, we're punishing him, it doesn't really mean that in a strict sense. It's kind of like a hashkafic interpretation, kind of like what we would call a tameh ha-mitzvos kind of thing, a taima dekra, but it's not really operative on a halachic level. It's not the real mechayev. We're going to see that in a moment. We'll see that the Minchas Chinuch says that. Now, when it comes to misas and shel rasha'im hana lahen v'hana la'olam, what's the obvious retort there? How can you read that alternatively? It's not that he's a Rasha now, but the same thing that animates the fact that it's good for a Rasha to die animates our motivation when we put to death this Bensoru Umura, right? The same. The whole idea behind Misas and Shavasham and Allah and Banal Olam is that we're saving them spiritually and we're saving the world from spiritual iniquity. So even if you don't want to tell me that the Bensoru Umura is not technically a Rasha right now, you can say that we're putting him to death for the same reason in order to save him. Now, this question of whether it is fully a result
Is it clear that Rasha there should be read? Should be read halachically?
Right. As opposed to?
Meaning it's in the middle of a Shkafic statement. So I think the easiest way to read the Mishnah is that halachically he's Zakai. On the strict legal level, he's Zakai. And then when the Mishnah goes into
Rasha, even a halachic word? What's the nafka mean?
We do have, of course, it's a halachic word. We have Psileidus. Psileidus based on Rasha. Is a Rasha? Is a Bensoru Umura? Yeah, I mean, presumably he's a Goslin, right? So Goslin is Pasleidus. That is the paradigmatic case of Rasha, which we didn't get into last year, but if you look at the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Chaf Zayin and Chaf Hey, that is the paradigmatic Rasha. So you're right. Rasha may not be meant in the technical sense, but again, we are, Zakai, I agree with you. The implication of Zakai and Chayav, okay? Has implications for being judged. Another way that you can read this is Zakai and Chayav in terms of the particular punishment that we are administering. Zakai and Chayav in terms of Onesh Skila. And again, that's something that we will, Be'ez Hashem, go into more when we talk about the particular Onesh. Why Skila in particular and the ramifications of that. We will get into that in future weeks.
Are there any nafkaminas between whether it's based on Sofo or the beginning?
We're going to see two right now, or possibly three. But we're going to see a couple of nafkaminas. right now. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a halachic question. It would just be a purely theoretical hashkafic question. Okay. You know what? Since maybe let's even look at the Minchas Chinuch first. We'll skip the source 9 for a moment, and we'll look at the strict nafkamina of the Minchas Chinuch. The nafkamina that the Minchas Chinuch gives is trefa. Let's say you have a ben tzora umora who fulfilled all the qualifications for ben tzora umora. He stole, he's eating in a gluttonous fashion from his parents, and his parents meet all of the requirements, their extensive requirements for what his parents need to do and how they act and things like that, and even their physical state. There are lots of qualifications, there are lots of boxes that need to be checked off in order to qualify as ben tzora umora. But let's say you have someone who checks off all the boxes, but he's a trefa. He's suffering from some illness that dictates that very soon he is going to pass. He is going to die. Let's say a week from now, he is going to die. Now, why would this be a nafkamina? For obvious reason. Why? Because the Minchas Chinuch says he's never actually going to reach the point where he is going to be molastem as abrios. We know he's not going to last that long. So the Minchas Chinuch poses a question as to whether or not this person would be considered a ben tzora umora. He says in source 9, ulecha ora l'tam ha-gemara, according to the reasoning of the Gemara that we just saw in the Ayin Beis Amud Aleph, the Yarda Torah Lesof Da'ato Shel Ben Tzora Umora, that the Torah analyzed the trajectory of the Ben Tzora Umora and realized where he's going to end up. Shesofo, and the Gemara explained, right? Just use the language of the Gemara. Shesofo, Migmar Nichse Avim Mavakesh Limudo Ve'ino Motze Ve'yotze L'Parshas Drachim L'Astem Esabrios. So that's all in the Vechule of the Minchas Chinuch, if we know what he's going to do. Aval Treif Abiyu Treifus Adam De'ino Chai Imkein Efshar Ein Bo Din Tzora Umora. Minchas Chinuch considers the possibility that if someone is never actually going to reach that point, that he is molastem es abrios, then he shouldn't be considered a ben tzora umora. We shouldn't be able to put such a person to death. Because the whole reason is that he's going to reach that point, and with this particular child, we know that he will not ever reach that point. According to the strict reasoning of the Gemara, he should not be a ben tzora umora. Ach be'emes, the Minchas Chinuch says, but if you want to know what I really think about this, if you want to know what I think the truth of the matter is, b'shem tama denasnu chazal, ein lilmod din mimenu. That reason that Chazal give on Daf Ayin Beis Amud Aleph, the whole thing that they said about Nidon Hashem Sofo, Yomus Zakai Bal Yomus Chayev, Yarda Torah L'Sof Da'ato Shel Ben Tzora Umora. You can't learn a halacha from that. He al da'as yovi ta'ameh ha-Torah. It's very nice, it's beautiful, it's a wonderful drasha. Use it in shul on Shabbos morning to tell us all about the ta'ameh ha-kra, like, you know, sometimes it's used in a little bit of a derogative sense among the Torah. It's beautiful ta'ameh ha-mitzvot, it's beautiful drash. But you can't use it in a halachic sense. Ve'ein lilmon mehenon, v'makom shepirshu chazal be'atzmon. In cases where chazal used that argument as a legal justification, okay, fine, shine. There, I'll admit to you that it's appropriate. Because there, Chazal themselves use this argument to justify a certain legal conclusion. But except, unless it's in a case where Chazal explicated that they are going to derive a particular conclusion on the basis of that legal reasoning, we cannot use that in order to make certain conclusions. So, you're right. Nidon al-Shem Sofo, Zakai v'al-Chayev, Yard the Torah of Ta'ato Shel Ben Tzora Umora. It really sounds like it is a proactive punishment if you just read the Gemaras. But according to the Minchas Chinuch, all of that is a nice explanation. But it is not; it has no weight, it has no force when it comes to our own halachic analysis. The ben tzora umora, if he did what he needs to do, if he checks off all the boxes, if he committed those sins, we are going to punish him in line with the punishment of a ben tzora umora, even if in a technical sense, he will never reach that point of molastei mesabrios. So that is the first nafkamina that is mentioned by the Minchas Chinuch. Another nafkamina that perhaps even emerges from the Gemara itself is the entire question of putting a katan, of putting a halachic minor, to death. At the very beginning of Perek Ben Tzora Umora, and Daf Samech Ches Amud Beis, it's quoted in source number 5, the Gemara asks the following question. This is the Gemara after the first Mishnah in Ben Tzora Umora. This is the first Gemara. The Gemara asks, katan minolan depater. How do I know that a katan is exempt from this din of Ben Tzora Umora? How do I know that a katan is exempt? That's a bit of a strange question, right? How do I know that a katan is exempt? How do I know? Katan is always exempt. So the Gemara asks that exact question. Minalan. You need to ask me where I know that a katan is exempt? What kind of a question is that? Would you ever ask me, how do I know that a katan is not obligated in tefillin or eating matzah or benching? You never ask that question. We know that a katan is not obligated in any of those mitzvahs. How can you even ask that question? I know that a katan, a young man less than 13, a young woman less than 12, is not obligated in mitzvah. So why are you even asking this question? Vesu, and furthermore, Heicha ashkechan de anash akasav de hachalipa ikra lemiftere. Furthermore, where do I find, Rashi says this is about onesh. Where do I find an onesh of a katan, that I would need a pasuk to exempt the katan from a punishment? Okay, even if you want to tell me that they're obligated to mitzvahs, we don't punish. We don't, is not in the business of administering punishments, corporal punishments, capital punishments, any punishments, to a halachic minor. So why in the world are you asking me, how do I know that a minor is exempt? And the Gemara answers as follows. Anan hachika amrinan. This is what we are saying. Adu ben soru mora al cheto ne'arag. Is a ben soru mora killed for the sins that he has already committed? Ashem sofo ne'arag. He's not punished. It's not a punishment for something that he has already done. A standard punishment is you did something wrong, now we punish you. It's not a punishment in that traditional sense. It's rather a proactive treatment for what the person will do. Bekimon de al shem sofo ne'arag, and because it's not a punishment for what was done already, but it is a proactive treatment for what will be done, perhaps, afilu katanami, I would think that perhaps even a minor is included as well. Be'od, and furthermore, that's a logical reason. And furthermore, the Gemara says, ben velo ish, katan mashma. It's called a ben soru umora in the pasuk. The first reason was a logical reason, the second is a textual reason. The child is called a son and not a man in the Torah. That implies a katan. So I'm reviewing Amarav, the Amar Kravachi Yelish Ben, Ben Asamach Leguraso Shalish. So Amar goes into a whole discussion. There's a very short time frame in which the Ben Zorumor is actually liable for this punishment. But we have this back and forth, this Shakla Vitaria in the Gemara. Perhaps a katan would be included because what? Because he's not really being punished for what he did. Look, you want to tell me that I can't punish a minor for something that they did because they don't really understand the ramifications, because they don't know, we can't hold them responsible. Great, I'll grant all of that. But if you're telling me that they're going to arrive at a particular place, and that's the whole reason you're giving them the punishment in the first place, why do I care if this person is 9, 10, 11, 12, 13? If I know they're going to do horrific things, let me put an end to it now in order to ensure that we never arrive at that result. That is the Havamina of the Gemara. Now, the big question is going to be, as always, what is the Gemara's maskana? We don't accept that idea. We don't allow them to punish a halachic minor. That could be for one of two reasons. Option number one is that, look, we still accept the premise that it's really about al shem sofo. It's really about the fact that ultimately they're going to arrive in a particular place, and we can't allow them to continue that trajectory and to arrive in that particular place. That's option number one. But that notwithstanding, despite the fact that logically, we really should put the halachic minor to death, we still can't do it. We can't do it. We're not in the business of putting a halachic minor to death. Not simply because they're not responsible for the sin that they did, but because Beis Din will not punish a halachic minor. In other words, it's a question, option number one, is it's a question in Onesh Katan. Why don't we punish a Katan? Is it because they weren't responsible for what they did? If that's the case, then should you punish the Ben Zorah Mora? Yeah, because it's not about responsibility for what they did in the past anyway. It's about what they're doing in the future. Option number two is that we don't punish a katan, not because of they were not responsible for the sin they did, because there's a din in Beis Din, that Beis Din will not punish a katan. No matter how much they deserve it, Beis Din is not going to administer capital punishment to a nine-year-old. So Beis Din just won't do that.
So you're trying to explain time as a crop, because the apostle says,
I'm just explaining, the logic in the Gemara. Exactly. In other words, that's what the Gemara is trying to do also, right? In that first stage, the Gemara is trying to explain...
Yeah. Well, no, the Gemara is trying to explain Havamina.
So what...
Why
so again,
do you need a Pasuk?
So,
the Pasuk is for whatever
this is,
reason.
Mayor, this is always a question when you have a Gzeiras HaKosov. Is the Gzeiras HaKosov just telling me that's the Halacha and that's it? Or is the Gzeiras HaKosov trying to indicate something about the nature of the Halacha? Whenever we have a Gzeiras HaKosov, that question needs to be raised. Right? Is Gzeiras HaKosov saying, oh, this doesn't make sense, but we have a Pasuk? Adkan. Or is the Pasuk trying to tell me something? That's exactly what I'm saying. In other words, again, when you have a Gzeiras HaKosov, sometimes, okay, logically, I really should put him to death, but it's a Gzeiras HaKosov, so I don't, right? The alternative is, the Gzeiras HaKosov is teaching me that my understanding of the Ben Soru Mora was perhaps somewhat misplaced or somewhat misunderstood. So option number one is saying that we don't punish the Katan, even though it is a punishment for what he's going to do. It's not even a punishment. Even though we're putting him to death proactively for what he will do in the future, okay? I still can't put a Katan to death. Whether you want to learn that as a Gzeiras HaKosov Meir because of the Pasuk, Ben HaSamach Le'ish, or we say it's because of a general din that based in won't be ma'anish a katan, not simply due to responsibility, but because it's a din and based in won't punish a katan. In any event, we're still saying that it's really about the future, but for whatever reason, they won't punish him nonetheless. What's the alternative? The alternative is, yes, you're right, the hava amina was, we are only punishing him because of what he will do. And according to that logic, it makes sense to put a katan to death. The maskana is, the Torah is telling us that it's not just about what he will do, it's also about a certain degree of responsibility for what has already been done. And because a katan does not have responsibility for what they have done already, you can't offer the punishment. So perhaps this Shaka Vatarya in the Gemara itself is dealing with this very question. Is it only about what he's going to do in the future? In that case, potentially you could put a katan to death. Or are we saying, no, it's also about a certain measure of responsibility for what he has done until now, and for that, you can't punish a katan because they cannot be held responsible for what they have done. Now, an interesting context where this comes up, that I put here, is actually in Sefer Bereishis. We have the whole story about Yishmael, about Sarah, Hagar, and Yishmael. Sarah demands that Abraham throw Hagar and Yishmael out. Abraham is hesitant to do so. Ultimately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him that whatever Sarah tells you to do, Shema B'Kola, listen to Sarah, and he does that. Okay? So in source number 6, we won't go through everything because we have to get to Cholent, obviously. But in source number 6, Abraham does that. He sends out Hagar, he sends out Ishmael, he gives them water, right? And ultimately the water is used up. So Hagar leaves the child. She can't bear to see her child dying of thirst. And she cries out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then in Pasuk Yitzayin, by Ishmael ukim es kol hanar. Significantly, God hears whose voice? The voice of the child, of Ishmael. Vayikra malach Elokim el Hagar min hashamayim, vayomer lo malach Hagar. A malach calls out to Hagar from the heavens. He tells her what's wrong. Al tirei ki shema Elokim el kol hanar, pa'asher husham. Don't fear, because Hashem has heard the voice of this na'ar, of this child, ba'asher husham, as he is there. A bit of a cryptic phrase. What does it mean, ba'asher husham? So Rashi famously says, ba'asher husham, v'imasim shehu osa achshav hu nidun. He's going to be judged by his status now, by what he has done until now. We're not going to judge him by what he will ultimately do. We know that Yishmael is going to be a violent person. He's going to be engaged in many averos, but we are not going to judge him by what he has not done until now. We are only going to judge him based on what he has done. And at this point, he's an innocent lad. He's an innocent child. He said the malachim say that the descendants of Yishmael who aren't going to provide water for the Jews, they're going to cause them to die of thirst. You're going to provide him water. At this moment, is this child righteous or wicked? Amru lo tzadik. Malachim answer, right now he is righteous. If right now the child is innocent, if right now the child is righteous, I'm not going to judge the child harshly on the basis of what he will do in the future. Now the Chizkuni, commenting on this Rashi, says the following. Basher Usham, source number 8, Pirush Rashi lefi ma'asav sha'achshav, in accordance with what he has done until now. And he asks a question. What do you mean? God's system of justice is that he only judges the child on the basis of their spiritual status and stature at the current moment? That if they're innocent at the current moment, they're not going to be judged harshly? What do you mean? We have the Ben Sorer Umora. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us explicitly, even though they don't warrant that punishment right now, we judge him by what he is going to do in the future, not by what he's doing at this point. Eliyesh Lomer Ben Sorer Umora. The Ben Sorer Umora has already taken the first step down that path. He's already gone in the derek of Risha, of wickedness, that is setting him on the path that he will ultimately be on. Has he reached that extreme degree described in the Gemara? No, he hasn't yet. But he's already indulged in that form of wickedness. He's already taken that first step on that trajectory. Aval hacha, mitchilaso Yishmael hayatzadik meosa avera. Yishmael here hasn't done anything pertaining to that avera that the Malachim described about his descendants causing the Bnei Yisrael to die of thirst. And that's what Rashi means, that he is judged right now. The Chizkuni is clearly indicating for us that what the Ben Sorer Umora has already done plays some role in the punishment that is administered to him. Now, the Cheskuni itself can be understood in multiple ways. You can explain it the way I was saying it before, that he's already done this Aveira, and when we view it within the broader framework of the trajectory that he is going on, it takes on a greater severity. It's not just a one-time thing that the person does now and he abandons. This individual sin is viewed within a larger context and a larger framework that forces us to view this as far worse than an individual or isolated particular sin. Or you could say the Cheskuni is saying that it's still Nidon al-Shem Sofo does play a major role, but it is not exclusive. You can't just have Nidon al-Shem Sofo, you can't just have the trajectory, you also need the fact that he has started down that path. Now, if the Cheskuni is saying the latter point, then it's still a lot weaker than the Menchas Chinuch. The Menchas Chinuch was saying Nidon al-Shem Sofo is entirely just hashkafic, it doesn't play any role at all, it's unless Chazal explicitly said that it makes a difference, right? The Cheskuni would be saying Nidon al-Shem Sofo plays some role, but the Avera plays a role as well. Correct, but he's giving us a chilo. Yeah, that is correct. Obviously, the Cheskuni is in a context of pshuto shel mikra or in a context of right, exactly, rather than a halachic context. But he's giving me a difference between Yishmael and Bensoru Mora. He is making a statement about the Bensoru Mora. He feels that the Bensoru Mora is punished. Why? Because he's already started down the trajectory that he's ultimately going to be going up.
On the Shemayim level, that's meaning on the question of his. Is Dovin Shalayim, that's true. That might not have any ramifications at all on the legal plane.
You're saying he might not... Okay, that's a fair point. You're saying that he might not... Like the Menchas Chinuch, you're saying the Cheskuni as well, even if he's saying that Nidon al-Shem Sofo plays a role, might agree with the Menchas Chinuch that the Trefa is going to be killed.
Right.
That's fair, okay? But at least on a broad level, he is indicating that the Bensoru Morek, clearly the sins that he has already committed, at least for the Cheskuni, seems to play some role in the way that we judge it. Now, one final nafkamina that I'm just going to mention now, because this is one of the main topics that we're going to have to analyze far more extensively, is the question of Malkus and Skila. So, in truth, the famous punishment of the Bensoru Remora is Skila, and rightfully so. That is the one that is mentioned in the Psukim. But the Mishnah on Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Aleph and Aleph, tells us that there's another punishment as well. If you look at verse number 10, Mazrin bo b'fnei shlosha u'malkin osa, that he receives Hasra'ah, he receives warning in front of three people, and we deliver Malkus. Chazar v'kilkel nidon be'esr mishlosha. If he does it again, then he's judged by 23. Ve'eino niskal ad sheyusham shlosha harishonim. Shner b'neinu zehu shalaka b'fneichem. That there are actually two stages to the Bensoru Mora process. One is Malkus, and the other is Skil. Now, something that we'll have to consider, and we're going to have to develop the relationship between these two phases far more, and that's going to be a very important topic within Bensoru Mora. But it's at least conceivable that perhaps these two phases pertain to these two components. When it comes to the sin itself, and we'll see that according to many Rishonim, it's an Isur De'oraisa. What Isur De'oraisa it is, the Gemara says that the Azhara is Lo Sochel Al Adam, and there are lots of other possibilities that are thrown out in the Rishonim. We will analyze all of them, Bezer Hashem, next week, actually. So it's possible that for the Lav itself, he receives Malkus. That's an appropriate punishment for a Lav. When the Gemara says Nidon al Shem Sofo, when it says Yamos Zakayv al Yamos Chayev, that's referring to specifically what? The question of why he receives this particularly severe punishment of Skila. So it's possible these two tracks of what he has done and what he will be doing are reflected within these two layers of punishment. Malkus is for what he has done, Skila is for what he will do in order to avoid that particular end. So in short, the first question that we're addressing within Bensoru Mora, and again, it's going to be recurring a bit, is the question of whether it's really all on what he will do or what he has done until now. We saw that there are languages in the Mishnah that imply either way. Certainly the stronger implication is that it's about what he will be doing in the future. We saw that the Menchas Chinuch argues that there's potentially a nafkamina for a trefa, for a child who will die soon and never will reach that ultimate result, that ultimate place where he's melastem esabrios. And the Menchas Chinuch argued that for all the lines of the Gemara that implies about what he will do, that's not really the case, and a trefa who will never reach that point will be killed as well. And we're seeing that potentially that's the discussion in the Gemara itself about whether a katan should be included in Bensoru Mora. Why is a katan not included? Is it because, really, look, it is about what he will be doing, but we still can't put a katan to death for the various reasons that we discussed? Or is it really that there's a component of what he did until now as well, like the Cheskuni was arguing in the case of Ishmael, and then finally we have the Malkus and Skila question, which once again we will delve into far more extensively in the future. So that is our opening to the Sugya and the Perek of Bensoru Mora.